Radio Free Alaska. Radio Free Alaska, the voice of freedom in an unfree world. Today is February 17th, 2023, and we're going to continue with our reading of Tusk, Book 1, Ella G. Kayotov. Picking up where we left off. Sandy was his name, a well-known heavy drinker of epic proportions who had been drunk for so long his friends didn't recognize him when he was sober. Sandy came in and one of his friends passed him one of the beers he had in front of him. Sandy just glared at Roger with his mouth open in a question mark. "Can I help you?" Roger responded. "Give me a head chopper," the old drunk demanded. "What?" Roger came back. "A head chopper. Give me a head chopper." Now, Roger was about ready to knock his block off and call that a head chopper when somebody in the saloon piped in. "He doesn't know what a head chopper is," the voice drawled. "He doesn't work here. He's just standing in." "Just give me the head chopper and stop messing around," the old drunk demanded. "Look," another voice said, "it ain't that hard. Just get out two tall glasses." Roger didn't hear any of it until the voice said it again. "Just get out two tall glasses." So Roger followed the instruction. "Now put 5 shots of gin in 1 glass." Roger at least knew what gin looked like. He got down the Gilbey's instead of the cheap junk in the trough and poured 5 shots into a single glass. "Okay, now take the other glass and get the Bromo Seltzer right there next to the cash register." Roger looked and found it. "Put a couple of tablespoons of the Bromo in the other glass." Roger did so and he heard another voice. "You'd better charge him before you let him drink it, or you'll never get paid." And Roger responded, $5. $5? I ain't paying you no $5 for a head chopper. The rate is 2. The old man was being kind. "Okay, $2 then," Roger said, and the old man paid. "Now take the gin and pour it into the Bromo and pour them back and forth in the glasses." So Roger followed that instruction, and instantly the gin was foaming. He spun them back and forth 2 or 3 times and then handed the final foaming mix to the old drunk, who polished it off in 1 glug. Roger just stared, not believing what he had just seen. And about that time, the bartender came back in with the steward. "Here's the steward with the master key," he said. Roger followed him out back up to his room. The steward apparently already knew which room was his. Roger retrieved his key. "You haven't seen my wife and son, have you?" Roger asked. Steward came right back casually. "They're up on the 3rd deck outside." Roger didn't waste any time. He went right up into the lounge and looked out the windows, not seeing anyone. He quickly went out onto the deck, and when he came around the corner, there they were, Ella G and child, and the woman sitting on the deck floor, laying back against the wall, sunning out of the reach of the wind and talking. Natty was sitting next to them, holding what looked like a half circle of steel in hand, and was rubbing the edge of it with a small flat stone. Roger went off like a steam engine, screaming and yelling and not bothering to care who the other person was or what she might think about the screaming. Anna watched his feet and never looked up, but she did not put the ulu back in her purse either. Eventually, LG adopted a 10-ounce vanilla syrup smile, got up, grabbed our tea, and went back into the stateroom. Chapter 5. There were strange things going on at the Bird Creek Mine. Some of the guys were talking among themselves in whispers and not talking to other guys who were also talking in whispers. None of them were talking to the bosses, even though the operation continued without a break. The three brothers who ran this operation for the Girdwood family were pushing hard. Hydraulic mining had a short lifespan in Alaska, particularly if President Eisenhower agreed to statehood. The territory allowed it, but it was certain that once a new government was installed under the feds, hydraulic mining would be fished up here. The brothers were known as the Coyotes, even though that wasn't their name. Their real name was Kyotov, but some kid in seventh grade started calling them the Coyote Brothers, and it stuck. The oldest was Big Jim, but he didn't run the operation. He had a hot head and a quick fist and a lot of muscle to back it. In fact, there was a day when another operation had moved into Spinard looking to jump claims. It was the O'Brien clan out of Spokane, Washington, or as they like to refer to themselves, the Fightin' Irish. Audi, the second of the three Coyote brothers, went over to visit with Dennis O'Brien and basically told him to back away from their claims or they'd be meeting Big Jim. The O'Briens, always ready for a few fisticuffs, hailed a taxi for the four of them, Dennis and Danny O'Brien, Mick Flanders, and Patty Collins, and they went to visit Big Jim at his house. When they arrived, Jim came out on the step, and when he realized what was about to happen, he put two fingers in his mouth and whistled the taxi with a loud shriek. The driver rolled down the window. "Hold that cab for a few minutes, would you?" Jim yelled at the cabbie, while he hustled down to greet the boys exiting the cab. And with that, he grabbed Patty Collins by the hair of his head with both hands and brought his face down hard on the edge of the front bumper of the taxi. Patty was out of commission thereafter. Danny was next. Big Jim anticipated his initial throw, which of course would be a right hook. He blocked it with his left arm and came down with a hammer fist on the top of his head, which was almost a foot below Jim. It was a debilitating blow which drove his chin down into his ribs, crushing the spine in his neck. Danny slumped on the ground unconscious. That left just two. While Dennis was a scrappy brawler, Mick Flanders was a sneaky snake who liked to use a knife. He thought it wise to slip the knife to Dennis in a way that Jim wouldn't notice. And the next thing Jim saw, Dennis was lunging the knife at his stomach. Jim brought up his left hand to block and caught the tip of the blade between his second and third fingers. Of course, in the same move, Jim brought across a punishing right fist directly to the nose of Dennis O'Brien, which again yielded a knockout. As he turned to face Mick Flanders, he saw something altogether new. Flanders had in his hand a Colt 1911 45 semi-automatic pistol, which he leveled on Jim's forehead in point-blank range. The gun barrel was touching his forehead. "I'd say you're dead now," he sneered. "I've got a good mind to blow your head clean off." As he tried to finish the statement, Big Jim hit him in the head so hard, Mick rolled back three steps and fell flat on his back on the concrete. Before he hit the ground, however, he started pulling the trigger, and in the space of 3 seconds, all seven rounds were gone. Big Jim walked over and took the weapon from his hand and put it in his waistband. He reached down and picked up Mick Flanders by the collar of his shirt, and he walked him to the cab and opened the back door. He then smashed Mick's forehead on the door frame, rendering him unconscious, pushed his body into the back seat. Jim methodically lifted Danny and Dennis into the back seat as well, one on top of the other, and put the now conscious but bleeding Patty Collins in the front seat. "You can take them back to where up whatever hellhole you found them. The one in the back seat will cover the fare," Jim said, and turned around and went back into the house. Then there was the middle brother, Audi Kyotov. Audi, he was named, behind the same inspiration that brought the name to World War II Audi Murphy. He was a long-haul truck driver and an operating engineer. He thought he preferred to skin cat, although he once lost a D8 up in the Matanuska Valley trying to blade an unyielding steep slope of impenetrable rock. It turned out that just below the 11 inches of dirt was nothing but a hard rock that wasn't going to be moved by a bulldozer. The cat cut loose and there wasn't any stopping it. Before it hit critical speed, Audi bailed off. The cat went over the edge and then down a straight drop of about 250 feet in a thunder of wrecked steel. That cat, or what was left of it, sits right there to this day. Audi kind of backed off on cat skinning after that and stuck to truck driving. Of course, truck driving in Alaska was a bit different than driving the truck in a lower 48. The roads, and using the plural here, was really reaching given that you had the Alcan, which ran from the Alaskan-Canadian border to Fairbanks, the Glenn Highway that connected Tote to Anchorage and down to Seward, and the Richardson Highway that connected Valdez to Big Delta. There was another highway called the Denali Highway, but such a name was really wishful thinking for a 100-mile stretch of unimproved dirt road. For about 6 months of the year, these narrow two-lane roads were often covered with ice. Of course, when you talk about ice in Alaska, a proper conversation is one which can distinguish between the various forms of ice. Sure, there was black ice, the kind you can't see until you hit some random patch and you lose complete control of your vehicle. But you also had your white ice, where the wet stuff had slickness. Generally, that kind of ice was predictable and could be managed with chains. Then you had the treacherous ice, which was when you had a hard ice pack on the roads, then a sudden warming where everything starts to melt, followed by a hard freeze during the night, followed by warming the following day and a little rain, creating a glazed ice rink with the surface of water over the top. Now that was slick ice and nearly impossible to even walk on, let alone drive. Yet Alaskan truck drivers drove no matter what the conditions. No matter what the conditions. This is what it meant to be an Alaskan truck driver. So Audi was the kind of guy that would not yield to the circumstances no matter how bad. In fact, the worse it got, the more likely he was to go. Endurance was his middle name and challenge was his last. He was like that when it came to personal combat as well. His lanky form and long musculature was to the eye misleading. He didn't look strong, but he was very strong. He didn't look fast, but he had lightning reflexes. Where Big Jim could knock you down with the fierceness of his blows, Audi held his own by using his very quick hand speed and great strength. He was a quiet man and stayed out of trouble. But when trouble happened, he was lethal. The youngest of the three was Ernest Kyotov. Now, he tried to go by Ernie Kyotov, but he had been dubbed the Coyote when he was in high school at Anchorage High because he was, in a word, rogue. He was shrewd, fast, and operated in the dark. His motto was something like this: cross me, slit your throat with a knife so sharp, you won't know you're cut before you bled to death. Coyote avoided conflict. He didn't mind running away from a conflict, even in shame, because he would return in the darkness of night or under a cloak of invisibility to retaliate, and retaliate he would, definitively and conclusively and with overwhelming vengeance. For instance, when Coyote entered eighth grade at the junior high age 13, he was attending school with guys who were driving their tow trucks to school as they made their fourth or fifth lap through the eighth grade. Some of these boys were full-grown men, but Coyote wasn't much of a frame at 13. One of these guys decided to make his reputation by calling Ernie to a fist fight after school where it was clear that Ernie was going to be seriously injured. To his humiliation, Ernie backed down in the hallway with impunity. An ignominious disgrace in front of the whole school, including the prettiest girls there. Ernie managed to talk with this guy, who outweighed at least 50 pounds and was more than 4 inches taller than him, into waiting until after school to pick the fight. During the next break, Ernie went to his locker and retrieved his blackjack. As they walked through the halls following the next period break, Ernie walked up behind the fellow and smacked him on the head with the blackjack, breaking his skull. When the fellow hit the floor, breaking his nose, Ernie put his foot on his neck and leaned down over him and said something about slitting his throat with a very sharp knife. Coyote was known to use handguns, sniper rifles, even hand grenades and dynamite to retaliate. He would take his time and wait until his enemy forgot about the fight. But the Coyote never forgot. He held grudges and waited out his enemy for the best, even the ultimate strategic advantage. Then he would strike with complete surprise and ultimate victory. Oftentimes, his enemies would not even know who did it, like that one guy who came home to find that a grenade had gone off in his living room during his absence. After this began to happen in high school, all kinds of ills were being assigned to me. car wrecks, broken bones, fires in the night, cars that would no longer run, literally anything that occurred for which they could not assign blame, blame then got assigned to Ernie. This is when they stopped calling him Coyotov and started calling him the Coyote. Now it was the Coyote who's the supervisor over the hydraulic mine operation at Bird Creek for the Girdwood Company. They had developed two monitors, water cannons to blast the soil from the banks of the creek on one side, and they had deployed sluices downstream to capture the water and soil coming down. The yield of gold was pretty high here, although not as high as it was up at Crow Creek. Besides the brothers, there were 12 guys working here. They had living quarters on site. The brothers had rooms built on the back of the office, and there was a bunkhouse for the other miners. There was a mess hall built up at the mining site where three meals a day were provided. Remember, however, that Coyote was in charge of this operation. As a result, all of the miners were armed. In fact, they were required to be armed to carry at least one handgun. They were required to work with their firearms on them. Now, issues were with four of these miners who were obviously talking to one another while casting looks at the brothers. The other miners noticed and were talking among themselves as well. There was something going on, but nobody knew what it was. Coyote sat in his office, cleaned and oiled his .44 Magnum. There was nothing like cleaning the handgun to give it a little moment of concentration and reflection. Coyote thought about how he would handle himself in a firefight, contemplating the nuances, the fear, and the methods of maintaining confidence and calm during the event. He also began to reflect on his family. Their father had died at age 34 very early on when he was caught in an avalanche down on the Kenai Peninsula. He had gone into Lake Tustamina to help retrieve a downed float plane, but a heavy snow trapped them there for nearly a week. They were required to snowshoe out. They headed due north towards Soldotna when the snow cut loose. It wasn't a big avalanche by anyone's standards, only about 12 feet deep. But when you're under 12 feet of concrete-like snow, it doesn't matter if the avalanche set any records. They were able to dig him out in a couple of days, him and two others, who had also died. And so the boys grew up in Anchorage without a father. Jim acted like the dad and saw to it that the family was protected, and protect he did. Their mother was an Athabascan Indian from Tanana near Fairbanks. She grew up in the traditional lifestyle and knew the Alaskan ways. She was very quiet and minded her own business for the most part. However, crossing her was not a good idea, as she carried with her that half circle of sharpened steel called an ulu. She had skinned many animals with that ulu, including moose and caribou, seals and wolves, sheep and goats, and had gutted many fish with the same. She kept it razor sharp. But Mama was not home now. She had gone to the lower 48 for a jury trial of all things, a murder trial as a member of the jury. After marrying her husband, who was an American citizen, she decided to become an American citizen. And once that happened, she was one of the few Americans in Alaska who was qualified to sit on a jury for an Alaskan case. When a murder charge was brought, however, the U.S. Marshal elected to try the case in San Francisco rather than a converted building somewhere in Anchorage or Fairbanks. Coyote hadn't heard if they convicted the guy or not. Usually up here, he thought, we'd just shoot him ourselves and drop the body for the wolves. However, this guy managed to get arrested and was sent down to San Francisco. How that happened is anyone's guess, most likely because they weren't sure if they had the right guy. Around here, getting arrested was a sign that they didn't know you were guilty. Otherwise, someone would have already taken care of the light work. Go figure, he thought. Anyway, his mother was finally on her way home, taking some passenger ferry from San Francisco to Seward. Chapter 6. As the days went on, the crews improved in stability and weather. Once they left Port Angeles, the water smoothed right out, and Roger could handle being on the ship. The first day of this smooth sailing brought a friendly smile and brought back a memory to Ella G of when they first met. There was kindness between them. But when Roger realized early in the morning of the second day that he could drink without puking, he went downstairs and bellied up to the bar for what turned to be an all-day and all-night event. It turns out that the protocol in that little saloon hinged around two things, the little bell that was rung several times an hour and a pair of dice in a wooden cup. Well, it also hinged around booze and lots of it. So Roger sat down 11:30 in the morning and ordered a beer. By noon, he had three in front of him, besides the one he was drinking. By 5 p.m., he had eight in front of him, and he had no plans to leave until he'd finished all of them. When Ella G realized that he wasn't coming back, she gathered the baby and wrapped him in the blankets and went again upstairs to the lounge. She was pleasantly surprised that it was not raining, but instead that the sun was shining brightly as the Juno Star passed by the northern end of Vancouver Island. She looked out at the sky, and when she did, she noticed the guy standing at the gunwale, where she had stood the day before. He was smoking some kind of small cigar, and he stood with his back to the oncoming wind. Him being there didn't stop Ella G from going to the gunwale to view the water as she had done the day before. She stood off from him, though, about a dozen feet, and paid close attention to RT, who was wide awake and looking around, not saying anything, but enjoying his shoulder. "What are you doing on this ship?" he asked Ella G, drawing near. "My husband and I," she said with some emphasis, "are going to Seward." "Why Seward?" he asked. "There ain't much there." "He has a job," she said flatly. "Well, that in that town, if you are without a job will find you on a fishing boat soon enough." Ellen G considered that for a moment. A fishing boat? She wondered if she could handle such a thing. "No, he's not fishing," she said, although she wasn't entirely sure exactly what he was doing. "He's working for Pat McKenzie." "Pat McKenzie? Patrick McKenzie?" he asked twice. "Well, I don't know if his first name is Patrick or just Pat, but yeah, I think that's the name, Pat McKenzie," she said. They were now standing close enough to hear each other, lifting their voices. "You haven't ever been to Alaska before, have you?" he inquired. "No, I haven't," she said. "How could you tell?" "Well, you'd know the name Pat McKenzie if you had," he said, and stubbed his cigar on the railing and flicked it with his fingers into the waiting sea. Ella G thought about this for a moment. She really didn't know what to say. This guy McKenzie, he was known all over the whole state? What could bring a guy into such a claim? "Are you saying he's kind of infamous in Alaska?" she said. "Oh, yeah," he answered. "He's practically a household word." "Should I be concerned?" she pushed to know. "I would be," he said, and prepared to go inside. She could see his body language and wanted to delay him. Ella G grabbed him by the sleeve. "Wait," she said. "Don't go yet. Tell me what I need to know." It was then that Ella G heard the familiar voice of Natty standing behind her. "Let me tell her, Vic, so she knows," Natty addressed her comment to the stranger. Ella G shot out a half smile, blending her concern with her recognition of Natty. "You remember I told you I sat on a jury for a jury trial in San Francisco?" Natty began to relate to Ella G. "It seems that Pat McKenzie came to Alaska to make money as an undertaker. He showed up in Anchorage with a line of coffins that he represented, and he had a license so he could embalm and cremate as necessary. He was the first funeral home director to arrive in Anchorage following the war, and he made a pretty good living off the dead. McKenzie had landed the only contract for the municipal cemetery at the corner of 6th and Cordova, just a few blocks down from the old airport, now the Denali Park Strip. With the monopoly of the municipality contract in hand, he became the only shop in town. All the dead ended up there. Sometimes in the coffin they actually paid for. Sometimes it was just a cardboard box. Pat McKenzie also liked the working girls in Spinard, but even when he was spending a bit of the budget on these girls, he often quipped about meeting that gold digger who was his future ex-wife. Sure enough, when Betsy Armistead came to town, he found just what he was looking for. Betsy was very pleasant and acted well at all social functions. She had an attitude that exuded snobbery, was viciously mean to other women, and a noted alcoholic whose attitude was condescending and abusive. But she always had a warm smile for Pat McKenzie. Once Betsy became Betsy McKenzie, which was a full 4 years into them sharing the same residence, she immediately began planning her successful divorce. The scheme included several things. First, she had to satisfy her biological clock, and that meant having a child. Then, of course, she would have to develop and otherwise manufacture an extended tale of spousal abuse, for in those days, divorce could only be had in Alaska by proving adultery, abandonment, or abuse, the three A's. Most Alaskan women didn't waste their time with her, as they would apply the Spinard divorce, shooting your husband when he was drunk. Although McKenzie was a wicked man in his own right, he was never violent. Instead, he was sarcastic, shrewd, even caustic. He had his own vicious tongue and a way of condescending that was both powerful and oppressive, without sparking impulsive violence from the other side. Instead, he would inspire a slow-burning emotion of quiet rage and a desire to get even among those who fell prey to his verbal assault. Betsy's plan to engineer a claim of abuse would take work. She set about the working plan before she got pregnant. Now, the pregnancy was a difficult one. She came down with morning sickness in the very first week and was sick every day thereafter until the boy was born. The last 3 months of the pregnancy, she was confined to bed rest only because the chance of premature birth was highly possible. It was during this period that she began to call her friends and tell them tales of being struck by Mackenzie or being pushed and so on. She also created stories of conflict and told of arguments that were in her mind, although these were things that she would never say out loud. Mackenzie kept on with this business of taking care of the dead, which of course made Betsy sick as well. She could really not stand the idea that the hands touching dead bodies during the day were touching her at night. And after the pregnancy, she terminated the physical contact between them. Mackenzie argued initially, but then he thought the better of it, electing to return to his old Hans and Spinard. This was the condition of the marriage when the boy was born, and it continued for several years. In the summer of 1956, Betty Armistead Mackenzie filed for abuse and rape. The adultery was easy enough to prove, but the abuse was a bit more difficult. She brought in her witnesses who testified as to what she had told them, but none of them had actually witnessed any of the things she described. It really didn't matter under Alaskan law to secure a divorce. A person was required only one of the three A's. As Betsy was only required to prove only one of the three, she succeeded in proving adultery by issuing subpoenas to seven call girls working out of just one house in Spinard. The divorce was granted and the custody of the child of the marriage was awarded to Betsy. In addition, she was awarded half of the marital estate, which included one of the two tall buildings in Anchorage and several hundred thousand dollars. She was also awarded that bright green 1955 Cadillac Series 62 Coupe. The car proved to be of significant repute. For Mackenzie, for his part, brought a motion to be reheard, which was scheduled 14 days later. He arrived at the courthouse, black 1954 Cadillac Fleetwood. Betsy, having enough sense not to bring their child to the hearing, arrived dressed to the nines. Mackenzie and his lawyer were both dressed in black suits. They were well down in the court's calendar, and the argument wasn't heard for an hour and a half. When they were finally called, Mackenzie made his point. Then the judge denied the motion. Betsy turned around and walked out without a word. Mackenzie and his lawyer packed up their documents and talked about their next move. They left almost 10 minutes later, and as they walked around the east end of the courthouse, they heard the blast. They quickly looked to the side of the blast, and as they watched, pieces of a green automobile rose up with the top of the blast. Mackenzie knew immediately what he was witnessing. Both he and the lawyer ran toward the blast. What they saw was devastating. Betsy had been blasted out of the car, and she laid on the ground about 20 feet from it. Her beautiful dress was blackened, as was the skin on her face. The Cadillac was now just a chassis with a piece of green sheet metal attached here and there. All of the glass was gone, the roof was clean gone, and the two front fenders and the hood were nowhere to be found. The epicenter of the blast was under the very center of the dashboard where the clock was. There was no floor in that area, no dashboard either. The front seat was gone and the back seat was shredded and burning. The trunk lid was gone and the taillights were blown out. The trunk was on fire, flames burning what was coming out of the gas tank. And with the suddenness, what remained in the tank blew in a small secondary blast. A black cloud rose from the car. And Mackenzie and his lawyer stepped back to avoid the blast of the heat. It was about that time that many people coming to the site of the blast were those people who had witnessed the entire event from the office building next to the parking lot. There were three of them. They would later testify to seeing the blast, and moments later, Mackenzie and his lawyer running into the parking lot and approaching the car, being forced to pull back when the gas tank blew. There were other people who arrived after that to witness the dead body in the ground and the destruction, but nothing else was known, and no one could testify to anything prior to the blast, except the bailiff in the courtroom, who would testify to the time Mackenzie and his lawyer arrived in the courtroom and the time they left, conveniently recorded by the courtroom time clock. The investigation began in earnest almost 3 weeks later and went on for over a year before the Anchorage Police Department finally made an arrest, and of course, they arrested Patrick John Mackenzie, charged him with first-degree murder. This finishes our discussion of Tusk for the day. Stay tuned next Thursday and Friday, and we will continue with Tusk Part 4 and Part 5. Radio Free Alaska, broadcasting the voice of freedom in an unfree world.